The Whole Health Cure with Dr. Sharon Berquist, the podcast that brings you inspiration and skills for living a healthy and fulfilled life.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back. So glad you're joining us again on The Whole Health Cure. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist, and on this podcast, we provide inspiration and skills to live a happy and fulfilled life. Today, we're going to be talking about workplace health management programs. I am honored and delighted to be joined by Michael Stauffacher. Michael has been the Director of Health Management and Central HR Administration at Emory University in Atlanta since August of 2012. In this role, he develops, implements, and evaluates health management programs and services for 30,000 university and healthcare employees. He partners with Emory's benefits department to ensure the health plan, that includes 48,000 members, and other vendor partners are accountable for health improvement. And this includes pharmacy benefit management, case management, disease management, maternity management, behavioral mental health, lifestyle management. So that keeps him, I'm sure, quite busy. So welcome, Michael. Thank you so much. And thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Sharon. It's good to be here.
And Michael, you and I have talked a bit about worksite wellness programs, motivating behavior change. And you've been in this field for now almost three decades. I know we were talking earlier about that we can now say that, which makes us feel, I'm going to say experience. That's the word I'm going to use. There we go. Yeah. And prior to working at Emory, you had worked for over a decade at Stay Well Health Management, and prior to that at the American Lung Association of Kentucky. So you've had a lot of experience in different, you know, companies and entities. And, you know, about 20 years ago, I don't recall any employer having a worksite wellness program. And now it seems all companies, large size, mid-size, have these programs in place. Can you speak a little bit about the evolution, how these programs evolved, and how we got where we are today?
Certainly. I would say that there were worksite health and wellness programs in the 80s, even in the 90s, were few and far between. There were some early adopters. I would say probably in the mid-90s, there's been an acceleration of worksite health and wellness programs, and I think part of that is due to the improvement in the research that shows the value, the effectiveness of well-planned, well-designed worksite wellness programs. And also, I believe it is due to the use of technology related to health promotion and wellness. Like all parts of our lives, worksite wellness has taken advantage of new technologies starting in the 1990s with the advent of internet-based programs and applications. Prior to that, the technology was telephones. There were a lot of programs delivered via telephone, virtually. And then in the 70s and 80s, it was mostly what you and I are doing today, face-to-face, one-on-one teaching and education and small group classes and coaching. And then after the 1990s, as we got into the 2000s and to today, the technology has boomed even more with the advent of mobile apps, with the advent of other virtual means of providing health education and wellness like telehealth, telemedicine, all of those things, I think, came together to encourage more employers to offer health and wellness programs for their employees.
And, you know, there's so much in what you just said, and I want to kind of deconstruct those various points. So I'm going to start off with kind of playing a little bit of devil's advocate with the research supporting employers investing in their employees. So there are always reports out there and headlines questioning the ROI or the return on investment in these types of programs. And you've mentioned that the research behind their effectiveness is one of the reasons that they have grown in popularity in different companies. So speak a little bit about why is it that there is such a debate around the return on investment of these programs?
I would say the debate is not universal. I would say the debate is isolated in certain sectors of not so much the health and wellness industry, but maybe those who are looking from the outside in and making comparisons to health and wellness programs to other clinical research, particularly randomized control trials. And even though it's difficult to randomly assign participants in the work setting, it has been done. And over the course of even the last 10 years, I think the consensus in the industry is that the research is pretty provocative. Now, there are always methodological issues with ROI, return on investment, and even the best studies, even medical devices, pharmacy, clinical approaches have the same weaknesses and strengths. In worksite health promotion, the industry has kind of stepped away a little bit from return on investment and has started to embrace a related term and approach called VOI, or value on investment. And that has, I think, been part of the adoption of wellness programs too, because VOI focuses on really many closer issues that employers are interested in, not solely cost, but issues related to absenteeism, productivity, absenteeism, morale, recruitment and retention. All of these things from a human capital perspective or human resources perspective are incredibly valuable, particularly in the past few years where employees are harder and harder to find and harder to keep. And so that is part of a strategy oftentimes with employers is having a robust wellness program. And we know from surveys of employees, not necessarily at Emory, but other employers, and also surveys from benefits consultants, showed that in addition to compensation and the type of work, employee health and wellness programs have risen to be one of the three or four or five top reasons why employees come to an employer, but also one of the top reasons that they stay.
It's interesting that that's becoming almost like one of the benefits. And when people are looking at the benefits package, that correct, that's being so heavily weighted. And your point about methodology is one that, you know, I can't emphasize enough because, you know, someone who is involved in research, it's always, you know, what you're measuring that determines how you evaluate your results. And with a lot of these worksite wellness, if the endpoint, for example, is hard data, things that are measurable, for example, cholesterol, blood pressure, that's a very different outcome than the softer, more subjective evaluations. As you mentioned, morale, which, you know, is very subjective. You mentioned absenteeism, but presenteeism, you know, being present at work, but not necessarily productive. And that's a very hard thing to measure. The level of engagement, right? Being there doesn't necessarily mean you're contributing or putting in your full effort. And I love this value return on investment, which I think encapsulates some of these more subjective measures that are so much harder to really evaluate. And when people are using these subjective components, what type of outcomes are companies reporting?
So, for example, studies have been done for more than 20 years on the effect of wellness programs, or more specifically, participation and certain levels of participation in wellness programs on absenteeism. And so that is a more objective thing that employers can measure. And it has been clear, there's several good studies that show that wellness programs have a positive impact on absenteeism, while things like morale and other issues are softer, as you put it. I think the Research around measuring those domains, if you will, is becoming better and better and will continue to get better. And so I think the evidence will just get greater, both on the financial benefits of health and wellness, but also on the non-financial benefits, and probably even more so because health and wellness programs typically don't show a hard return on investment for at least 3, sometimes 5 or 7 years. When you think of the trajectory of what influences healthcare costs, it is things like physical activity, nutrition, stress management, sleep. And so there is a long arc or curve, and it's not always a straight line. It's not always linear, that can have a positive effect on healthcare costs in the short term or the long term. And so that's one of the, I would say, the unique differences and probably one of the measurement challenges for health and wellness programs is there isn't always a direct line between starting a stepping campaign and walking 10,000 steps a day and then showing a change in costs related to diabetes.
Yeah. That is a really interesting perspective. I think when that amount of time, a 5 to 7 year lag, occurs from when a program's implemented until there's a measurable improvement in outcomes, it becomes also, I would imagine, muddy to make that cause and effect relationship, which, you know, adds to the difficulty measuring it. And on top of that, I think if you're going to your leadership asking for more money, it takes a bit of a leap of faith to say, just pour money in for 7 years. I promise in 7 years you'll be glad you did. So are those some of the challenges?
Yeah, I'll give you an example here at Emory, and many large employers over the course of time have looked at the research, not just the research within the employer we're talking about, but looking at the field and said, yes, this makes sense. If we apply the appropriate principles of planning, implementing, and evaluating comprehensive programs over a period of time, we believe that there will be a financial benefit, even though we might not fund a formal ROI study, because ROI studies are extremely expensive, take a long time, and there's always this discussion in our industry. As an example, taking $100,000 to do an ROI study, we could use $100,000 to provide direct benefit and programs to our employees. And I think more and more employees are looking at that second option, that they believe that the research is good enough in addition to all of the other softer benefits of health promotion and wellness to make the investment. Here at Emory, we have very enlightened leadership, and we measure things more related on value than the specific cause and effect. We believe health and wellness, in addition to other benefits, medical benefits, our work-life program, our EAP program, the things we're doing with our healthcare partners at Emory Healthcare, and also our pharmacy benefit manager. All of these things contribute to value both for the employee, but also value for Emory as the employer.
And I think it helps that we're a healthcare organization. It's a little easier sell than I imagine in some other big companies. And you touched on engagement, and this seems to be a real challenge in a lot of worksite wellness programs. So there's always the question of, are the people that are more motivated to participate the ones that are already doing the 10,000 steps a day? And, you know, are you really reaching out to the more, you know, if I may say, couch potato people? Or are you just adding to the benefits of the people who are very willing and able and already doing a lot of the wellness programs regardless?
Here at Emory, but also in my experience in working with other Fortune 1000 companies in my prior life, The evidence is strong that we're reaching a wide sector of risks, so to speak. And we know that, or we believe that, because we look at biometric screening data, and we see that the percentages, the prevalence of, for example, pre-hypertension and hypertension mirrors what we see in other populations. We look at the health risk assessment data, and we see that the self-reported inactivity and poor nutrition choices give us evidence that we're reaching very low-risk people, moderate-risk people, and high-risk people. The other benefit of health risk assessment data is they typically assess things like readiness to change and motivation, and we're also reaching people along the continuum of those who are not ready, not thinking about change, thinking about change, making a plan, they're in action, or they've been maintaining new behaviors over a period of several months. And so there is a lot of evidence that I see in our program and other programs that we're not just reaching the worried well.
Yeah. And of the people we're reaching, for any company, not just Emory, what is considered a successful level of engagement? Like, what are targets? Do you want 20% of the employee workforce, or is it 80%? Like, what's a good benchmark, and what's the goal?
Most employers set those benchmarks for their own organization, and it's informed on previous participation, but also benchmarking against other employers in the peer-reviewed literature or in from other settings, like at conferences and papers, you can do benchmarking. We also do benchmarking through our benefits consulting group. They let us know what they're seeing in their book of business in terms of participation. And obviously, more is better. And so I don't think there is a standard answer for that question. From Dee Eddington at the University of Michigan published a study many years ago, and he showed that over the course of time, after about 60 or 70%, that was really the goal, is over the course of time, can you have a cumulative participation in a variety of programs of 60 or 70%, and then you start to see and maintain those benefits in terms of healthier lifestyle and the other metrics of interest.
And is that because once you cross over, say, a 50% mark, you've kind of crossed a tipping point where there's a culture change? Is that part of why?
That's a good analogy, a tipping point. And there are a lot of ways to measure that tipping point in terms of participation and engagement. But also in the 6 years that I've been here at Emory, there are a lot of informal metrics that you can point to. A good example here at Emory is I think we've reached a tipping point in terms of building a culture that is supportive of and engaging in daily physical activity. In the buildings, I'm seeing more people using stairs. When I walk at some of our campuses who have established new walking trails, you're seeing employees out more and more. You're seeing more people in our food service locations choose healthier options. Here at Emory, we implemented a program a few years ago called Better Choices, and it's merely a labeling program where we label the healthier choices both on the menu but also on the package or the cafeteria line, and we have seen a tremendous increase in the purchase of these better choice items over the course of time. And so there are a lot of, you kind of triangulate and the data from different sources to make sure that things are aligning.
And among the different things that we've implemented here at Emory and you've seen implemented in other places, what types of programs are the more successful, you know, because some companies in some places probably do certain things that perhaps, you know, if I, again, can play devil's advocate, maybe check a box, but don't necessarily lead to engagement or any measurable change. And others are very invested. The leadership changes a culture. So what are the key elements of success?
From a program planning perspective, you mentioned one, I would say leadership support, but I wouldn't stop there. It really is visible, engaged leadership support where leaders throughout the organization, not at, just in the C-suite, are actively promoting and participating and talking about programs on a regular basis with employees. And so that's key. Communication is key. Not just more and more and more communication, but thoughtful communication and designing the communication to fit into the culture of the organization. Here at Emory, we went through a rebranding activity right after I arrived in 2013. And we redesigned the brand. It wasn't just a logo. It was the look. We branded all of our programs Healthy Emory, and we wanted the look and the brand and the feel to be positive. We wanted it to be fresh. We wanted it to be interesting, simple, eye-catching. And I think one opportunities for improvement in a lot of health promotion wellness programs, a deficit approach is taken. You have risks related to diabetes and heart disease and cancer versus a strengths approach, building on people's strengths, building on their interest, building on their motivation and values. And so and that's hard to do at a population level, but it's easy to do on a one-on-one situation. And many of these areas of interest are or can be collected on health risk assessments, employee feedback survey. And so you use all of these data elements and find out what are the common factors across the population and use that to guide your communications. Also, incentives are important. It's clear that incentives drive participation. It is still under debate whether incentives drive behavior change. We at Emory have taken a relatively conservative approach to offering incentives, being sensitive to the fact that it doesn't make sense either from a personal perspective or a business perspective to have such a huge incentive that that's driving participation, because you are very much at risk of replacing internal motivation with an external motivator. And that's hard to maintain both from a business perspective but also from a financial perspective. So we've used financial incentives attached to our health plan judiciously, and we intentionally tie it to our health plan and communicate that to employees, that one of the reasons we have most of our incentives tied to the health plan is what we do on a daily basis, every day, 365 days a year, has an impact on my, as the employee's, healthcare costs, but also the healthcare costs of Emory, since we're self-insured, we're self-funded. So I would say that's been very important. And also I would say reducing barriers, making it as easy as reasonably possible for employees to participate. And so think very hard. We think very hard and hopefully thoughtfully about, does this step add any value to the program, or does this really, is this perceived as a barrier by employees? And you're always looking at the pros and cons, and sometimes things are working against each other, and you have to make a judgment because you're trying to measure things. And when you measure things, you have to have people register and you have to have people do certain things so you can track them. So, but we're always thinking about the employee experience. And when you're planning and designing and delivering programs for 30,000 employees across a huge metropolitan area, that can be a bit troublesome sometimes.
Yeah, and you know, the barriers must also factor into the types of programs you choose to offer. And as you mentioned in the beginning, there's been an explosion of digital programs. And, you know, I think you and I probably both get a lot of people who've designed various programs, different vendors who approach us and ask us to implement this in our patients. How do you choose amongst now the myriad of different programs?
So I'll give a recent example. We, about 3 years ago, we went out to bid for a technology partner. And we made the business case internally of the value of the services, this technology partner, both an internet application and the mobile application, which we have branded Healthy Emory Connect. And we went through a very detailed RFP process with our benefits consulting group. And what they, because your point is well taken, there are literally dozens of vendor partners who want to be our best friend. And it's hard to keep up. It's hard to know who's doing well and who isn't doing well. So that was part of the benefit of securing a consultant to help us identify what our goals and objectives are for this procurement, help us look at the field and narrow down which vendor partners would best meet our needs. And then we went through a very thorough process to identify those partners and vet them. Probably similar to other large employers and other large academic medical centers, we had a committee. We had an enterprise-wide committee of employees both from the university and healthcare help us in that selection and procurement process. And so it's a big investment, and we anticipate a big return, not a financial return, but a big return in terms of participation, engagement, morale, and some of the other areas of interest for health and wellness here.
And for other employers going through the same decision-making process, what were the critical elements that made you choose the current vendor?
A lot of it had to do with, for lack of a better word, which partners' products we felt fit our culture. And so we were looking at, again, did they take a strengths approach versus a deficit approach? Was the technology easy to use? Was it? Did they have product development plans that would continue to meet our needs in subsequent years? And then there were, you know, very specific things we were looking for. Here at Emory, we've been focusing on physical activity, nutrition, and stress management as part of our Healthy Emory strategic plan. And so we were very intentional in finding a partner that had strengths in all three of those areas so we could continue to reach employees. And it's been a very good journey with them, and particularly as part of our healthcare system, the Emory Clinic, and now as Emory Healthcare expands with other hospitals, recent mergers and acquisitions, the employee base is spreading further and further away. And so it's physically impossible to have equity in terms of program offerings that we offer here on the main campus because our team is here. And so part of the decision was this technology allows us to reach all employees with a higher level of equity and offering all employees equal opportunity to earn health plan incentives and to feel engaged.
Yeah, and I think a lot of companies have that same challenge in that they're certainly headquarters, but most are geographically, you know, spread quite far apart. So that's
Absolutely.
A really important component just for equity amongst all employees.
Absolutely.
I'm going to ask you to take out your crystal ball and tell me, where do you think these worksite wellness programs are headed? Like, what is the next step and what's the future of them?
I think technology will continue to drive the industry and will continue to innovate in terms of how, when, where, and why we reach employees. And so I'm looking forward to that. I would also see the industry continuing to move toward how does health and wellness, health and well-being, probably more accurately, provide value to the organization in terms of recruitment and retention and productivity. I think measurement is going to get better in these areas. And then I think similar to some recent changes, there may be new areas of focus that employers may not have considered even 5 years ago. An example might be sleep. The research related to sleep has gotten quite provocative over the last several years in the influence of sleep on so many health indices. And we, I think, have known for shift workers and others who work rotating shifts, we have known for quite a while that that has had an effect on their health and productivity. But I think we're seeing, because of a variety of influences, that sleep is affecting almost the entire population. And so
we certainly see that in the clinic.
Yes, yeah. And not just related to sleep disorders per se, but related to things of great concern like diabetes and obesity and many
Stress.
Other chronic conditions mm-hmm. or syndromes. And so I applaud Emory in being willing to start that conversation with our employees related to the importance of sleep and how we might better support employees in getting more high-quality sleep and what are the tools and strategies that they might use to do that.
Yeah, I think those are all wonderful points. From the standpoint of, you know, again, running these programs and you do it, I think, Emory, we're the second largest employer. Yeah, so pretty large employer. Any advice to other people and other companies? Any reflection on kind of lessons learned that you'd like to share with our listeners?
I would say some things that have guided our work here at Emory and to a greater or lesser extent can be applicable to all employers of all sizes is do some strategic planning. Understand, we have a term in public health called a logic model, and we identify the outcomes of interest and then start working backward. And so that is one of the tools that we utilized in our planning for Healthy Emory. We knew that we wanted to reduce obesity. We wanted to reduce the prevalence of diabetes. So what are the precursors to that? Physical activity, nutrition, stress management, a number of other things. And so you start working down the line, and then it becomes very clear on a day-to-day basis, but also over the course of time, why are we doing this? What's the reason that we exist? I would say that think about communications, think about your culture, engage your leadership early and often. Here at Emory and similar to other large organizations' leadership changes on a regular basis, and so you have to be very thoughtful and intentional about being aware of those leadership changes and engaging new leaders who come into the company. And I would also say that probably as important as the formal leadership with titles, we have informal leaders throughout the organization. Those people who may not have a title of director or vice president or manager, but they are people within work groups or teams. They're kind of the go-to people, the people who know what's going on, who have been there for a long time. Those are your diamonds in the rough. If you can get those folks on your side, you're golden. And I would also say that even for smaller or mid-size employers, the idea of having a cadre of wellness champions is also key. A lesson learned here at Emory and also in previous jobs. These are volunteers, essentially, who are your boots on the ground to communicate, promote programs, but also they're your voice of the employee. So it's a two-way conversation. Our wellness champions, whether they're on a surgery floor in the new hospital tower or whether they're in the new research building on Haygood or they're in campus services keeping our roads and grounds beautiful, these folks understand our employees probably better than anybody. And so having that group of wellness champions, those volunteers, is a lesson learned, and I would highly recommend employers think about that.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for so candidly sharing so much of your insights, and thank you for all the work you do to keep Emory such a healthy work environment. I appreciate it all.
It's great visiting with you. Thank you, Sharon.
The Whole Health Cure is brought to you by the Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness Center at Emory. For more information about wellness assessments, classes, and other resources, please visit our website. This material is copyrighted by Emory University.